Welcome to Building Tomorrow, a podcast about how tech and innovation are making the world freer, healthier, and more prosperous. Today, we're talking about cryptocurrency and the dream of decentralized currency. I'm your host, Paul Matsko, and with me is Cato's Director of Emerging Tech, Matthew Feeney. He's also the one among us who actually owns most crypto, I think. Let's give out your cold wall address here.
No further comment.
He's a hodler through and through, though. So, and joining us in the studio is special co-host Diego Zulaga, a policy expert at the Cato Institute's Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives. He's also the snazziest dresser, I should say, on our floor of the office. So that's obviously the real reason we're having you on, but welcome to the show, Diego.
You know why I am? It's because I didn't lose any money on the crypto that I don't own over the last few months.
You can actually afford clothes, unlike Feeney.
I also don't think on the Cato sixth floor, that's a particularly high bar. No offense to Diego, but we're not the most.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. You came
very,
in.
You're like... very kind, though.
Let's start with a kind of a basic concept. So cryptocurrency advocates love to talk about how Bitcoin, Ether, other currencies are decentralized as opposed to traditional currency. What does that mean in theory when we talk about decentralized currency?
So usually what we mean when we say that these networks are decentralized is that exchange that these networks facilitate is not made possible by someone standing in the middle and talking to the person sending, let's call him A, the person sending something to B, and then interacting with B and making sure that whatever A sent was in fact actually sent, and that the payment that B promised in exchange also happened.
So I send you a check for $10. You want to make sure that $10 is real, because that's just a piece of paper.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, whether it's on eBay or on Uber or say a payments network, Visa or MasterCard, there's traditionally always been an institution in the middle that, first of all, designed the conditions under which exchange should take place, the sort of information you needed to provide, what sort of characteristics you had to have, what sort of licenses and so on, and then verified that, in fact, the exchange had taken place as it should have. And the idea was that that way you increase trust, you minimize fraud, and you enable more economic activity that's productive for everyone to take place. Now, the innovation of networks like Bitcoin or Ethereum is that they don't rely on a centralized counterparty. And instead, the conditions are created in the software protocol that gives birth to these, such that individual users can help other individual users verify the information. And the reason they do so is because they have some sort of monetary reward that comes as a product of that. So let me give you an example with Bitcoin, which is the first decentralized network. It was proposed as a system in late October 2008 by someone writing under the pseudonym of Satoshi Nakamoto. And he called it a, quote, peer-to-peer electronic cash system. And in that particular case, you would own tokens, you would own bitcoins that you could send electronically to anybody else with a Bitcoin address, which is basically your identifier on the network. And the way in which that transaction would be fulfilled is not by someone in the middle saying, actually, the funds have been sent and you have the means to deliver, but rather other people will work very hard at resolving a mathematical problem. Whoever resolves it gets the reward and gets to write the transaction into what's called the Bitcoin blockchain, which is the ledger that's visible to everybody in which all transactions are recorded. Now, in order to win this contest, if you disagree with everybody else, say because you want to defraud the system, you want to push through a transaction that isn't true, you have to expend an enormous amount of energy because otherwise you have a very little probability of being assigned the transaction. So it's not very rewarding to go against the consensus of the system. And in that way, you encourage virtuous behavior. You're leading other users to do the things that serve other users best without having to have someone in the middle. So that's the contribution.
It's a way of having trust without an intermediary.
Exactly.
Is the kind of the idea.
That's right. Okay. So the role of the intermediary is instead performed by a combination of good mechanism design at the outset and then virtuous behavior encouraged by economic incentives as the network evolves.
Mm. Now, you wrote a chapter for an upcoming volume, Voices of Liberty, that we're actually putting out as part of the Building Tomorrow project.
Visions.
Visions of Liberty. Yeah, sorry. Visions of Liberty. I'm an editor. I don't even know the
name. There you go.
Publishing two books now.
Yeah. That's right. And you have a nice turn of phrase. You have a nice way, I think, of putting this problem of intermediaries, making it accessible, I think, to a broader audience, which is imagine if we inserted a new intermediary into every one of your transactions. And the example you give is that of a translator. And this actually isn't all that out there. There are people who need translators to perform basic functions, and it's a major drag both on their ability to be a productive part of the economy, and just it's a pain. So imagine if every time you had to go buy groceries, you had to hire a translator to come along and negotiate or be the go-between between you and the cash register person. And this introduces lots of problems, right? Like, do you really trust your translator? Are they saying that those groceries cost $100, but in reality they only cost $80 and the translator's pocketing the difference? You will never know because you have to rely on this intermediary. And I think that's a really great way of conceptualizing the problem of intermediaries and thus why we have this kind of energy behind early cryptocurrency advocacy to, well, let's get rid of these intermediaries if we can, right? This it introduces friction in the process, and that friction is bad. We want a frictionless transaction. At the same time, though, you do seem a bit skeptical of the idea of complete decentralization. And maybe you can explain for our audience some of why. Like why – so we have this vision of, hey, Bitcoin, Ether, these other cryptocurrencies, we can remove all intermediaries. It's always going to be just point-to-point exchanges. Why might that not be an achievable vision?
Sure. Can I first perhaps give three examples just to make a more graphic illustration of what I mean when I talk about intermediaries? So imagine yourself as a European or an American tourist in a Moroccan souk, in one of those street markets where you're buying things and you have someone accompanying you telling you what the merchant is saying. Mm. You can't understand what they say, but they can make you understand what the merchant says, hopefully, and also they talk to the merchant on your behalf. Now, it's obvious that he might be put in a position where the merchant gives him a share of whatever gains he makes, and he doesn't necessarily have an incentive to tell you the entire truth. He might say that a bargain you want to make is not actually, you cannot strike it, that he might lead you to someone that is not the providing you with the best goods and services or whatever it is, and on that basis, take advantage of you and try to vitiate the transaction. That's a way in which sometimes the market power, we would say in economics, of translators can cause bad outcomes. Another case is North Korea. We've all watched probably documentaries about life in North Korea. And when people visit North Korea, they're assigned a government chaperone that leads them everywhere. And that person is overseeing their activity while these people are in North Korea, but also are reporting to the government on what these people are doing, what these people think, they read their emails and so on. So another way in which this role of intermediary can be violated is through government surveillance. And, you know, we have plenty of examples of this, even in freer societies with the NSA eavesdropping scandal and so on. Now, the third case is when you're trying to navigate the legal system and you hire a lawyer for that. The lawyer effectively is your translator for those activities. Now, in that case, of course, the lawyer is also vulnerable both to government abuse and perhaps to his or her own abuse of your ignorance of certain things for his or her own advantage. However, it would probably be too costly for us to navigate the legal system on our own. So it's probably efficient to have something like a lawyer. And the question is, to what extent, on what scale, does it make sense to have an intermediary or not? And this is when I come back to cryptocurrencies. Because even though I think it is technically feasible to have a completely disintermediated system where everybody interacts on a peer-to-peer basis, I don't think very many people beyond crypto enthusiasts who are expert in the technology and then libertarians who value particularly autonomy and privacy very highly would necessarily want to do everything on their own. They'd be quite happy for somebody else to take custody of their crypto, for somebody else to provide some oversight, for somebody else to make sure, provide certain information to government authorities for their tax purposes and other things. And that might be efficient because it's much less costly than doing everything on one's own. And my own expectation is that if this technology is to become something mainstream and major in competing with the traditional intermediaries like Visa, MasterCard, Amazon, Uber, you name it, there's going to have to be some sort of intermediary function performed there. And indeed, we're already seeing it.
Well, I was going to ask, if exchanges like Coinbase might be an example of something like that. In part, perhaps because they do a lot of the heavy lifting new entrants find difficult, which is handling your keys and actually buying crypto. Do you think that's right? Are these, those are the kind of institutions you're talking about when discussing crypto intermediaries?
Absolutely. I think Coinbase is a good example because it serves several functions. First of all, if you're new to this world, you go to Coinbase and you find one of the biggest exchanges, and whatever they list, you know, will to some extent be compliant with existing regulation. There's, of course, a lot of uncertainty, but you can be pretty sure that if a large company like Coinbase lists them and you buy them, you're not going to be immediately in trouble. Or at least you'll have some recourse, someone to talk to if you have any issues or problems. The second thing they do is they collect your information. And so for in the world that we live in, where government does control a lot of our activity, and you have to comply with a lot of those regulations in order to operate, it's good to have somebody do this on your behalf, to ask you for the information that you actually need to report, and to do it in a way that is that minimizes the hassle for you. And then the third thing they do is they facilitate interaction in faraway places, because Coinbase happens to be licensed all over America, and it happens that if you're a cryptocurrency exchange, you need a license in every state that you operate in. So being part of Coinbase means that you can trade with a lot more people than you otherwise could. So those are three key functions of an intermediary that Coinbase is serving. I mean, not to say just Coinbase, there are plenty of other exchanges there, but you know, it's just one of the bigger examples. And it's one way in which the mainstream adoption of this stuff is facilitated.
It seems like it's partly a question of not allowing the ideal to be an enemy of the best to be an enemy of the possible, right? So we can acknowledge that in an ideal world, everyone would have equal levels of knowledge, would be equal entrance into an idealized market. They would, you know, there would not be barriers of language, of power structure, of, you know, surveillance, etc. But at the same time, we don't live in that kind of world. So while it might be great if we all went to our Moroccan souk and we said, you know what, I don't like the fact that I have an intermediator, this translator, who is who I can't fully trust. So I'm going to learn a little bit of Moroccan, right? Enough to get rid of. Well, that might help. For some people, might have the time and luxury of learning a little Moroccan. But have you learned enough Moroccan to truly have a superior advantage over? I mean, are the risks of misunderstanding with a little bit of limited Moroccan, are those risks greater than the risks of having an interpreter who you can't fully trust? But most people don't have that luxury. We can't go learn a new language. We can't go and study law by ourselves, most of us, right? So sometimes if the goal is the minimum amount of friction in transactions between individuals and institutions, sometimes the intermediary is the way of having the least amount of friction for the maximum number of people. And I think the same thing applies to cryptocurrency, where just as not everyone can learn Moroccan, not everyone can study the law, not everyone is capable at least at this point in time, of figuring out the ins and outs of buying their own cryptocurrency, of maintaining a cold wallet and, you know, the security, not losing their code, and et cetera. In fact, there's probably some experts who aren't capable of that, given all the stories of people losing their Bitcoin passwords to their chagrin. Makes for a great article, but when you lose $100,000 in cryptocurrency, I'm not sure that's worth it. So it seems like we have that's one of those things, is that there is an early energy that says, here's an ideal, a completely decentralized, intermediary-free way of exchanging goods and services, you know, with the original vision of Bitcoin. But it's possible to allow that vision, the kind of purist vision, to obscure the ways in which, well, actually, sometimes intermediaries are good and helpful. If we want this to be a going mass market proposition, we need to come around to understanding that.
Well, yeah, I thought along those lines about the wake of the most recent crash and the publication of the Bitcoin white paper, because if the last 10 years, I think, have taught us anything, is that actually, while a lot of people are upset about the crash, they weren't upset at the concept of intermediaries per se. They were upset at a lack of regulation or oversight. They actually like the fact that, well, if I have a bank account, I don't have to carry money around everywhere, and I have deposit insurance, and if there's ever a transaction dispute, I have a party to go to, and people like that, right? And I think Diego's really onto something, pointing out the actual narrow or small population of people that are really enthused by this. Not least, of course, is the issue we haven't talked about, which is a price fluctuation, which if the original point of the thing was to be an actual competitor to the dollar or the euro, the pound, it's been a bit of a failure at that. But there are potentially other applications, right? Decentralization isn't just something applicable to currency. Diego, do you think that that currency is still the field in which crypto has the most potential? Or do you think in 50 years we'll look back and we'll actually see it as a technology that started that way but became applicable to many other things?
I think it's going to be difficult for any cryptocurrency to become money because it's not a sovereign money in the first place. So you cannot pay your taxes with it. And again, you know, the world that we live in, a lot of our liabilities on a year-by-year basis, and one of the most certain of our liabilities are taxes, right? Nothing more certain than death and taxes. There's some truth in that. And then the second item is that sovereign currencies have been in circulation for a long time. And so a bit like the first mover advantage with any social network, launching a new money means that you have to persuade enough people to adopt it that other people will have a strong incentive to adopt it. And that makes it, unless you have a huge technological advantage or the incumbent does a terrible job, like in Venezuela, where people are actually taking up Bitcoin because it's more stable than the Venezuelan Bolivar, makes it very difficult for a challenger to succeed. I think the payments function is probably still the best or the most the closest use case that will be viable in the future. I see a lot of, first of all, because payments are in many ways quite inefficient at the moment, particularly in America. And then secondly, because the technology is very well suited to the transfer of value in that sort of way. And I think their disintermediation actually stands a chance of, in the short term, overcoming some of the costs that have traditionally affected the payment system.
Do you think that crypto technology has applications for anti-corruption schemes or programs? Your mention of Venezuela just prompted me to think of this, right? If one of the applications people talk about are smart contracts, right? That if you can show that actually, no, this is my title deed, I do own this property, this is how much, it makes, if that became more widespread, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, it might be harder for governments to engage in bullying of citizens or bribery, corruption. If it's easier to prove who owns what, it seems to reduce incentives for that kind of behavior.
That's right. I think in a lot of low-trust societies, removing the role of the government in assuring a lot of these very basic identity issues, who you are, what you own, who your family member is, what belongs to you, can be very advantageous. Of course, governments still have a monopoly on force, which means that if they're very stubborn about it, they could very well still impinge upon you and abuse you and so on. But they're going to have a hard time justifying to the outside world that what they're doing is actually legitimate, because you will always have something to point to that is outside of the control of the government that shows that, in fact, the government is lying about the state of affairs.
Yeah.
It's kind of an additional hurdle or barrier. I mean, at the end of the day, if you're in a country with a unreliable kind of governance structure, and the wealthy landowner in the next village wants your little plot of farmland, they go bribe an official in the capital. You can't even make it to the capital and leave work that long, and they go drop a bribe and, hey, guess what? The central record repository says this land actually belongs to the wealthy landowner. Well, you can say, well, no, here's my smart contract showing that this land actually belongs to me. And yeah, at the end of the day, if the police force comes and kicks you off the land at the behest of the major landowner, that only helps you so much, but it's an additional hurdle for them to overcome. And that's a marginal improvement and a significant improvement. And there's some people's lives, that hurdle is enough to prevent them from losing their property rights, or to allow them to turn that into security, a way of leveraging for a loan or improving their life in other ways. I can show I have property, so I can get a loan on the basis of this, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal, even if it's only a marginal improvement. I like something else you said, Diego, which was from the Venezuela example. So you have a place where a dysfunctional central government with runaway inflation. So their central bank has been, I guess, printing money to try to keep up with inflation, destroyed their currency. And you also have subsidized electricity. So the costs of mining Bitcoin are artificially low. So you get a lot of crypto mining there. And so what's interesting is that Bitcoin, based off its original premise by Satoshi, is a failure arguably in the US, at least with its original intent. But that is kind of his intent in Venezuela. I mean, as an alternative currency, a way of kind of hedging against government incompetence. That's actually really interesting to me. So even if Bitcoin doesn't become a kind of a transactional currency in the US or other more stable developed nations, you can argue it's a good thing for the global community to have it there as kind of a backstop when countries go to hell, kind of like they have in Venezuela. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And perhaps the way to describe it is as a deterrent to the worst forms of tyranny. The moment, you know, some people believe that nuclear arms, their one saving grace was the fact that they act as a deterrent to people behaving in very bad ways, particularly great powers. And I think there's something to that. And in this case, you are lowering the cost of opting out of the state for a lot of people who are oppressed. And I think that's a very beneficial effect. And indeed, what you see is that precisely the jurisdictions which are most subject to tyranny or most vulnerable to tyranny are the ones that have most enthusiastically adopted this technology. In some places like Russia, the government is actively trying to co-opt a lot of the programmers because they have some experience in co-opting a lot of the smart people who otherwise would deploy their talents to undermining the system. But in Venezuela, it seems like a good escape for some people who are suffering a lot. So to the extent that cryptocurrency always will exist as an alternative, that I think changes the game a little bit for would-be tyrants. Hmm. And the other item, of course, is that it's just been 10 years. Yeah. Electricity took about 40 years to deploy all over the US. If you look at some, you know, the statistics around the impact of electricity on US GDP, they only really become visible in the 1920s, late 1910s, 1920s. The network effects take a while to take hold. So I wouldn't give up on the technology just yet because it hasn't been absorbed by a large enough number of individuals. I think that can eventually happen. And of course, the technology will keep improving. There's a tremendous amount of work going on. It's not something static that Nakamoto invented and then he went off and disappeared and that's going to be it. That's the revealed word. No, these things will be living and improved.
And arguably, I think the real test, at least in the US, will be, I mean, so this is Bitcoin's kind of live by 2009. He writes in 2008. But we're already into the economic recovery then. And we've been in a fairly steady pattern of recovery in the 10 years since. Who knows if that'll continue. But for now, so Bitcoin has only existed in the period of economic prosperity in the United States. It'll be interesting to see what happens next time we have a major financial or economic crisis. Will that provide room? I mean, in a sense, will it act even as a backstop for a developed country like the US? I don't know.
I'm in the middle of getting ready for one of the semi-regular lunches we do here at Cato, where a bunch of colleagues bring lunch and we have chats. And for an upcoming one, I was looking over one of the Mueller investigation's indictments of a bunch of Russians for their behavior during the 2016 election. And through reading the indictment, it's fascinating, actually, the amount of state use of crypto that's gone on. So that these Russian intelligence officers allegedly, you know, they had Bitcoin so that they could purchase VPNs and use servers in Malaysia. It's a technology like any else. It can be used for pretty nefarious reasons as well as laudable ones. But that's an unavoidable feature of any technology, I suppose.
Absolutely. And if you watch spy movies from the 60s, you will see that a lot of the deals that happen are in Swiss francs and done in Geneva under some Swiss bank account. Doesn't mean that Swiss bank accounts are a bad development. In fact, they were a very good innovation and they saved a lot of German Jews from being completely expropriated by the Nazis in the 1940s. So as Matthew says, it can be used for good or ill, but technology is neutral.
We actually have a writer writing a column for Building Tomorrow right now. I asked him, he's Swiss and has some knowledge of like kind of Swiss financial history, why the Zug Valley in Switzerland is such a hotbed of cryptocurrency innovation and speculation. And we'll see what he says, but I'm interested in if there are ties to that tradition of Switzerland as a haven from financial regulation, if it's just kind of a continuation of that legacy for the digital age. So mm-hmm. So we'll see. We'll keep an eye out for that article. A few other points you made, Diego, in your essay, and you mentioned it here, which was the idea that there is a legitimate use of decentralized cryptocurrency to kind of smooth the process of payments. And you mentioned specifically international payments in your essay. Why international as opposed to domestic? Why is that kind of one of the most promising avenues for crypto being relevant?
I think the main reason is that you have so many hurdles to exchanging funds across borders. First of all, because you're dealing in separate sovereign currencies. Then second of all, because those sovereign currencies are managed by central banks. And then thirdly, because a lot of banks in countries like the United States, particularly with a fragmented financial system, simply don't have international ties, which means that if you're trying to send money from, say, the US to France, you have to probably send, first of all, you have to have funds in your bank account. That bank will have a relationship with a bank in New York, to which it sends the funds that you wish to send to France in the first place. From your New York correspondent bank, as it's called, that will go to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve will transfer the funds. This is all simplified, but will transfer the funds to either European Central Bank and then to the Bank of France, which is the Central Bank of France, or directly to some French correspondent bank. And then finally, it goes to the recipient. Mm. So we're talking about five or six steps there. Now, yeah. Because of the various regulatory regimes and the banking structure that we've got, it's simply very costly to transfer funds across borders, and you're always exposed to exchange rate volatility. Now, for a limited period of time, the risk will be borne by your bank, but they're not going to do it for free. They charge you for it. And the end result is that for a lot of retail transactions, say $2,000-$3,000, which is what most people send at any given time, you know, that kind of number or even lower, that kind of figure, you will have 5-7% of it being lost in fees. So it's very easy for even a relatively costly new technology, which is what cryptocurrency currently is, to overcome that if they reduce the number of steps that you have to go through. A prominent example is Ripple, which I think at this particular moment is the third biggest cryptocurrency by market cap, but it's been fluctuating with Ether for the second spot for some time now. And they're a bit different from most cryptos in that they were originally designed by a group of programmers as an international payments crypto. And then those people said, we're going to set up a separate company to use this cryptocurrency to transfer funds across borders. And so it doesn't operate on the same kind of process, electricity-heavy process that I described for Bitcoin earlier. But the point is that what they do is they will take your dollars, they will transfer them into XRP, which is the native currency of Ripple, and then they will convert those into euros. And all of the transfer of value happens within the XRP network, which means that you don't have any of the hurdles that I described previously. And all you are left with is the exposure to XRP and the exchange rate value with whatever currency you're transferring from and into. And so as a result of that, they claim to be able to lower fees by about 60%. So that's a major improvement over what's given. They're still small. They're still relatively experimental, but from what I've seen, they seem to have a compelling proposition. And, you know, it's one of the applications that, as I say, looks like it will be at least competitive with existing technology in the near future.
Yeah. And if you can make that transaction cost 60% cheaper, you're avoiding kind of a deadweight loss in the sense that, like, this is activity that doesn't have to happen now. This is money that can be spent on other economically productive things. And I think it's, you know, in there that a disproportionate amount of international money transfers are by the most impoverished, right? So it's workers in one country transferring relatively small amounts of cash to families in the home country. Mm-hmm. These are people who that bump, a few percentage points extra income, can make a really big difference in their ability to sustain the family back home and the like. So it has a very kind of a progressive social impact as well on these folks. There was something else. We've talked about smart contracts, international payments. This might not be as quite as sexy as some of those other implications, but you also mention internal corporate supply chains. This wouldn't be cryptocurrency as much as the blockchain itself. So it doesn't actually have to be currency. But maybe explain that for our audience a little bit.
Sure. Well, anyone who works in a relatively large organization knows that database management is a nightmare. And one of the problems with database management is that right now most of us have them as files on our computers, on our desktops. And oftentimes they won't even be updated with new information unless we actively do so, even after other people have input new information. And if you're trying to coordinate with other people, it becomes a nightmare because somebody's name is wrong, or you didn't realize that they were married, or they lost their job and it's not incorporated, and things like that. And so it can reduce, or it can lead to a lot of waste of effort and time within an organization. Obviously, the advantage of decentralized ledgers is that they're automatically updated. And the advantage of using it within an organization is that you don't have to rely on electricity-heavy processes to make sure the transactions remain true. Because after all, it's still within an organization. The organization controls the ledger, and it can define who has access to it and who doesn't. So it removes some of the issues that we've described with what are called open blockchains. These are called permission blockchains or private ones. And from a transformative perspective, it's probably less impactful simply because you're dealing still within an organization, but it probably has quite widespread applications. It's a bit like a more heavy-duty use of Google Sheets or Google Docs, sort of things that we sometimes use when we're sharing documents across people. Or, you know, we use Notion to put together a list of topics that we would discuss on this podcast, things like that. So I think that's the way, that's what I would compare it to.
Cool. Now, I think we're ready to move topics to something that you brought to the table, Matthew. Which is, it fits with that decentralized vision, right? There's a group of cultural, social, political commentators in the US, Dave Rubin, who's a podcaster, Jordan Peterson, who's kind of a public intellectual. And there's been a growing concern among certain corners of, I don't know what you call them, the New York Times called them the intellectual dark web,
right?
Dramatic term, mm-hmm. But among folks who don't feel like their views belong in kind of the mainstream rhetoric, that they're being squeezed out by payment processors like PayPal and by platforms like Patreon, and they're looking to crypto as kind of a decentralized answer to their problem. Can you explain some of that more for our audience and what the significance of that is?
Sure. So some listeners might be familiar with this controversy, but it really fits into maybe a corner of the battlefield where the ongoing culture war is being waged, right? So there is ongoing concern about what people call deplatforming or censorship with popular platforms, whether they're Twitter or sites like Patreon, which is a site where content creators can raise money for their projects. There was a recent controversy about Patreon booting a particular user for comments he made off of Patreon, but nonetheless was accused by Patreon of violating its terms of service. And this prompted some high-profile people like Peterson Rubin and Sam Harris, the neuroscientist and atheist commentator, to say they were going to leave Patreon.
And there's some real money at stake here. I think Peterson was getting $80,000 a month through
Patreon.
Yeah,
they're making quite a bit of money from this. And it's a big move for, especially, I think, more so probably Rubin and Harris than Peterson, because for people like this, this is probably their primary source of income, right? And the reason I threw this into the notes is because Rubin, since announcing he was going to leave and leaving, has mentioned crypto quite a few times, saying, well, it's not just pressure from companies like Patreon, but there's pressure from payment processors. And he cited complaints with MasterCard, for example. And as most people know, banks and payment processors do discriminate certain customers, whether they're, you know, gun manufacturers or people who work with pornography. And this, I don't know, it got me thinking. At the moment, I don't know if there's an asset out there, cryptocurrency, that's ideal for this. Bitcoin may be the closest, but the price fluctuates so much. It's also not anonymous. But Rubin and Peterson are in the middle of building a competitor to Patreon, where I'm sure they'll be taking crypto as a payment. But that's one way, I suppose, one application of this, right, is as a way to circumvent processes that for better or worse, right, feel under pressure to not associate with people with certain political views. So in the long term, maybe crypto makes it harder to push people out of the public sphere. But I think it's too early to tell.
Yeah. Well, there's an interesting degree to which, like, Diego laid out some values, right, in his essay and here in the, on the show about, well, you want efficiency in transactions. Most people also want convenience. So things like cost, efficiency, convenience, transparency, and
accountability, is another one.
Yeah.
So having someone you can turn to for redress if something goes wrong. I think most people, libertarians perhaps less so, because we are more conscious of risk and more willing to bear it if the reward is more autonomy. But I don't think that represents the typical person.
No,
and I think we need to be aware of that when we discuss these things.
We're weird. Let's just.
I just a little anecdote, but last week, as Paul mentioned, you know, I have some holdings in this stuff, but I have a cold wallet, right? And you have to put in your password. But there is no bitcoin.com that you can, you know, email or phone number to call if something goes wrong. And I kept on putting my password in, and it just was not working. And I was, you know, panic starts setting in about the sixth time that this doesn't work. But the lesson is make sure that your caps lock is off when you're trying to do this stuff. But it was a real moment of, if you send these kind of assets to the wrong address, they're just lucky. You know, like the people you could, there's no redress at all.
Yeah.
It's a cost benefit analysis.
And maybe you're willing to bear that additional inconvenience or risk or the lack of accountability in exchange for, well, I can say whatever I want on here. There is no intermediary or maybe an intermediary with a lighter touch between me and my payers. And so it's worth it, right?
Yeah,
and that's I guess the calculation that people like Rubin are making.
Right, but even Rubin, I think, and his allies have to be careful even in making the shift to crypto, because if they shift to an intermediary like Coinbase that we discussed earlier, they could run into the issue that Gab, the kind of the alt-righty racist Twitter, because they had a Coinbase account and then Coinbase booted them off. So it seems like just adopting crypto isn't enough. You actually have to adopt it in such a way that there is no intermediary like Coinbase or company like Coinbase who can still influence you. It's got to be a kind of cold wallet, do-it-yourself operation.
Now, you kind of got in trouble a bit with the Rubin fan base because you were actually defending Patreon's right to push them off. Right?
I think anyone who looks at these debates will find plenty of examples where platforms can be accused of hypocrisy and for not applying their standards consistently. So Patreon claims that this guy, Carl Benjamin, violated their terms of service. Whether you want to treat Patreon as the authority on Patreon's terms of service or community guidelines is another conversation. But there are plenty of people who seem upset at Patreon because they think this is being arbitrarily doled out and that Patreon's not really being fair. And what I wrote was, well, if Ruben and Peterson are upset, then they are welcome to go and start their own thing and find the more information in the market, the better. You're always going to be disappointed by intermediaries like this. But I think in the long term, I'm skeptical that the kind of competitor that they're building will be successful, because their unique selling point is that we're more tolerant of this kind of speech, which is speech that I think a lot of people find distasteful. But time will tell, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a certain irony of folks entering into the marketplace of opinions and being annoyed when the marketplace isn't a huge fan of their opinion, right?
I mean, Well, we had news today, so we're recording this on Wednesday, the 16th of January. Roku announced that they're actually going to pull the plug on
Alex Jones,
yeah. Right? So I'm sure we shouldn't be surprised if Alex Jones starts talking a lot about crypto as well, because part of the problem is not just getting a platform for the channel, but getting funding for the channel, because people don't want either their bank knowing that they support this guy, or they don't want that found out.
Man, this is really bad PR for for cryptocurrency, though, because you can imagine a world. I mean, the last attempt to create an alternative to Patreon was the gun 3D printing, Cody Wilson.
Oh, Defense Distributed.
Defense Distributed. Yeah, yeah. He tried to kickstart Hatreon.
Hatreon, that's right.
Which, again, not, you know. So the idea of alternatives to these mainstream payment processors and platforms and these alternatives being fueled by crypto is like, this is where hateful people can go and exercise their freedom of speech. And we would defend their freedom of speech. But if your concern is the long-term like viability and thus the image of cryptocurrency is not just a place for, you know, the Silk Road drug exchanges and sex trafficking. And if you're concerned about that image, it's probably not great that you're, you know, the big people who are flocking to your banner are Alex Jones and, you know, Jordan Peterson. Not that I put him in the same category as Alex Jones per se, but
yeah,
at the same time, that's why these things exist, to provide access to free speech for even unpopular and
that is precisely the dilemma of decentralization, is that there's no one there to put a fence on anybody joining.
Yeah,
you can, so long as you own a token that is native to the network, you can interact whether you're Alex Jones or Mother Teresa.
Yeah,
and so that's a virtue in a way, because it makes censorship very difficult, but it also means that perhaps distasteful people who we would like to counter. I mean, as individuals, I don't mean there's any sort of kind of justification for trying by statute to counter these people. Right. But it's not easy to limit them. On the other hand, when we leave it to intermediaries to decide and let people in or out on their own judgment, there's the danger that they will do it excessively.
Yeah.
That they will, you know, this is what John Stuart Mill warned us against, saying that that we shouldn't discount the possibility of social tyranny, not one that is enforced by the government, but rather by a group of people who find themselves a large enough majority to be able to impose their mainstream opinion on people who disagree. And often the people who disagree are wrong, but other times they're right and they're revealing a new truth and they're making us better as a result of that. And that is a possible danger. The other consequence, of course, particularly in the world that we live in, is that intermediaries will find themselves with a politically imposed duty to serve everybody, because they exercise this function of being the gatekeeper so much that a certain corner of representative politics gets annoyed and forces them to welcome everybody.
Make them a common carrier.
Exactly, like a public utility.
Right, you're seeing arguments like this coming from, of all people, self-described conservatives and some people who call themselves libertarians, is, hey, we should just treat Twitter and Facebook as if they're common carriers or monopolies, and that they have an obligation to carry speech that's legal, which is certainly not an approach I would support. But I think that's indicative of actually where we are in public political rhetoric, that this is being seriously considered by people who describe themselves as fans of limited government.
And I think we have a robust philosophical apparatus as libertarians for dealing with this question. Like, here are people who are some of whom are legitimately hateful or are, you know, not promoting edifying conversation into the public conversation. But at the same time, if you don't extend the you know, sometimes it's like the right to exit. Right. This is historically the question of regulation of religion in places like Great Britain. It's if you have a state church, are you going to tolerate dissidents? And dissidents say, well, we want the right to exit, to go to another country, to the Netherlands, to the colonies, right, to Massachusetts. And so battles over right to exit. What we are talking about here is, in a sense, a right to exit. Will we allow people to leave these mainstream processors and whatnot to exercise their potentially hateful or paranoid speech? But if we want to have that freedom for ourselves, ultimately that's the price we pay. The price we pay for freedom of speech is allowing Nazis to speak hateful speech, right? Which is why groups like the ACLU will defend, you know, the famous Skokie, Illinois case. Like, we're used to that as libertarians in the IRL world, in the non-digital world, when it comes to legal jurisprudence. It's not that hard to imagine applying those same principles to cryptocurrency, to the world of payment processing, to these realms we're talking about here. We just have to realize, oh, it's really not that different of a use case. I think one last thing I wanted to touch on here, I don't know if you guys had heard about the double spend attack on Ethereum. happened earlier this month.
On Ethereum Classic. Which is a smaller version of Ethereum that was created as a result of what's called a hard fork that happened in 2016.
Yes. So most people took the fork, right?
Just to clarify, because Ethereum is the second largest cryptocurrency.
Yeah, so, but by size.
If you hold an Ether, don't worry. It was a different network that was attacked.
Probably.
Maybe you should worry about for other reasons, because it hasn't been doing very well recently, but not for the double spend attack.
So I think some of our listeners are not going to know what the double spend attack is. So real quick, maybe Diego, do you think you walk them through simply what is a double spend attack?
So we call a double spend attack a situation in which I, Diego, promise Paul to send him funds in a cryptocurrency network, and in some way I'm able to promise them to somebody else, and both of you record that the transaction has gone through to both of you so that I can actually obtain more value that I can afford. And normally this shouldn't happen. If a cryptocurrency network is well designed, then it should prevent, by this mechanism of competition and the resolution of a complex mathematical problem, the situation in which someone can write wrong information on the ledger. But we mentioned the importance of computing power. If you have sufficient computing power on one of these networks, you can actually fool the rest, because you have a majority of the effort that's being expended. And therefore, you can, for a period of time, you can fool everybody else into believing that both of those transactions are truthful. And because of the design of these networks, that whoever has put more information into the ledger is the one that is followed, it can sometimes be successful. That is a double spend attack, and that's a situation in which it can happen. The reason it happened on Ethereum Classic is that it's a small network, it's relatively easy to summon enough computing power to do so, and they happened to be able to do it. It was relatively cheap.
It's hard to imagine that happening for Bitcoin or either the non-classic either, because of the sheer size and cost.
Yeah, to give listeners some idea, it would cost anywhere between $300,000 and $500,000 to attack the network for an hour. Mm. And that still doesn't guarantee you that you'll be able to defraud anybody. So unless you have a tremendous amount of overwhelming computing power, which gives you a lot of certainty about the ability to defraud the system, you probably don't have an incentive to do it. The other reason, of course, is that Bitcoin, if you're involved in this space and you have the ability and the incentive to attack the network, you probably have holdings in crypto. Yeah. And an attack that discredited the network would probably hit your bottom line. So even if you're in a position to do it, you probably don't have a long-term incentive in doing so, because it's bad for you.
Maybe to put this in a easy conceptualized manner, it strikes me as fundamentally similar to check kiting, or various forms of check fraud, I go to the bank and I've created a fake check saying that you paid me $10, and I take it there and they cash it for me. But the problem is that you actually haven't agreed that transfer. Your bank is not going to send that money over, but they won't know until the end of the business day or when they settle up their accounts. All the banks communicate with each other, with the Federal Reserve, with the central bank, and say, these are all the payments that were approved. But there's a lag of time between the check being written and cashed and the settling up process. And the same, and people can take advantage of that. Banks usually tolerate a certain amount. I mean, they'll prosecute you, but they're willing to put up that risk because people demand convenience. So usually they'll release a certain amount of a check you deposit right away, even though there's a risk that you are defrauding them. But they're willing to do that again because people want convenience. But that's kind of fundamentally what's happening here. You have a block of the blockchain that's still being written, and our transaction, the money you're sending to me, is written on there, but the settling up process isn't done until the entire block is written, or a number of blocks are written, and that gets more complicated. But there's a period of time at which it's on the block, but will that be the final block that makes it on the ledger? And that whose block gets to settle up depends on how much computing power you have.
That's right.
Am I kind of getting that right?
Okay. So because the heuristic is whoever has the longest chain is the one that everybody else follows. That's the chain on which everybody continues to build. So that if you have enough computing power, you for a period of time will be able to get ahead from the truthful chain. And in that way, yours becomes the truthful one. And in that event, and if that is discovered, you need to have a hard fork, which is a redesign. It's basically going back in time on the blockchain, which is not supposed to happen because these things are immutable. And then two chains emerge. and you get Ethereum Classic and you get regular Ethereum as a result.
It also requires some kind of central action to do that, which is kind of a big no-no.
I mean, that's right.
That's why hard forks are so controversial, is because the whole point was that a central authority shouldn't be allowed to go in and
that's right.
make those kinds of decisions. So it often causes, I mean, it was a big deal when Ether made that fork.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Back in the day. Why shouldn't we be all that concerned about that, though? So you mentioned it's really expensive to amass that kind of computing power. There was something else you mentioned which had to do with if you have amassed that power, there's a handful of miners who tend to exercise a disproportionate amount of power and could do this. They kind of like shoot themselves in the foot, though, if they are involved in that kind of action. What is that? Can you kind of flesh that out for us?
Sure. Let me make the following analogy. Imagine you are someone who has the resources, is very wealthy and has the resources to rob a bank effectively. But it happens that that person is also a major depositor at the bank and has a lot of their funds at the bank. It could get a lot of funds as a result of robbing the bank on one day, but if the bank goes bust and cannot pay back its liabilities on the next day because not only of the robbery, but because it's completely lost its reputation and it's had a run by every other depositor, then you're probably hurting yourself in the end because of your actions. And there's a similar thing in play, I suspect, with a lot of the people who would be in a position to attack any cryptocurrency network because they own a lot of computers or they somehow are able to rent them. And that means they have knowledge and they have access to resources. And that probably means they've been doing the mining for some time, which means that they have some stock of crypto. And therefore, attacking the network, unless the potential gains adjusted for the probability of winning, which is another thing, outweigh your existing stock, you're not going to do it. So I think it's more difficult than most people assume. Alex Tabarrok pointed out this event on Marginal Revolution, his blog with Tyler Cowen, and he said that one of the deleterious consequences of crypto prices going down is that you suddenly have a lot of spare capacity among computers because you no longer require as much computing power to push through transactions, nor do people have an incentive to be involved, in that spare capacity might be deployed for deleterious purposes to try and rob networks. But I don't think we have enough evidence to argue that's the case.
It was good timing for him because he wrote that article on like January 8th and then the double spend on Ether Classic happened on January 9th. Right. So, you know.
Maybe he had a tip. We should probably right. check it out.
Should be investigating Alex here. Yeah, that's right. Well, thank you guys for coming in and talking about decentralization and crypto here. We can all rest a little bit easier. You're probably not going to be falling prey to a double spend attack, but we should cut things off here because our intermediary with a capital I, our producer Tess Terrible, will give me a hard time otherwise. So until next week, be well. Thanks for listening. Building Tomorrow is produced by Tess Terrible. If you enjoy Building Tomorrow, please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.